Chapter 12 St. Julian Perlmutter was a classic gourmand and bon vivant. Excessively fond of fine food and drink, he reveled in sociable tastes, possessing an incredible file of recipes from the renowned chefs of the world, and a cellar with more than 4,000 bottles of vintage wine. A host with an admirable reputation for throwing gourmet dinners at elegant restaurants, he paid a heavy price. St. Julian Perlmutter weighed in at close to 181 kilograms, 400 pounds. Scoffing at physical workouts and diet foods, his fondest wish was to enter the great beyond while savoring a 100-year-old brandy after a sumptuous meal. Besides eating, his other burning passion was ships and shipwrecks. He had accumulated what was acknowledged by archival experts as the world's most complete collection of literature and records on historic ships. Maritime museums around the world counted the days until overindulgence did him in, so they could pounce like vultures and absorb the collection into their own libraries. There was a reason Perlmutter always entertained in restaurants instead of at his spacious carriage house in Georgetown outside the nation's capital. A gigantic mass of books was stacked on the floor, on sagging shelves, and in every nook and cranny of his bedroom, the living and dining rooms, and even in the kitchen cabinets. They were piled head high beside the commode in his bathroom and were scattered like chaff on the king-size waterbed. Archival experts would have required a full year to sort out and catalog the thousands of books stuffed in the carriage house. But not Perlmutter. He knew precisely where any particular volume was stashed, and could pick it out within seconds. He was dressed in his standard uniform of the day, purple pajamas under a red and gold paisley robe, standing in front of a mirror salvaged from a stateroom on the Lusitania, trimming a magnificent gray beard, when his private line gave off a ring like a ship's bell.
"St. Julian Perlmutter here. State your business in a brief manner."
"Hello, you old derelict."
"Dirk!"
he boomed, recognizing the voice, his blue eyes twinkling from a round, crimson face.
"Where's that recipe for apricot sautéed prawns you promised me?"
"In an envelope on my desk. I forgot to mail it to you before I left the country. My apologies."
"Where are you calling from?"
"A ship off the coast of Peru."
"I'm afraid to ask what you're doing down there."
"A long story."
"Aren't they all?"
"I need a favor." Perlmutter sighed.
"What ship is it this time?"
"The Golden Hind."
"Francis Drake's Golden Hind?"
"The same."
"Sic parvis magna," Perlmutter quoted. "Great things have small beginnings. That was Drake's motto. Did you know that?"
"Somehow it escaped me," Pitt admitted. "Drake captured a Spanish galleon."
"The Nuestra Señora de la Concepción," Perlmutter interrupted. "Captained by Juan de Anton, bound for Panama City from Callao de Lima, with a cargo of bullion and precious Inca artifacts. As I recall, it was in March of 1578.
There was a moment of silence at the other end of the line.
"Why is it when I talk to you, Julian, you always make me feel as if you took away my bicycle?"
"I thought you'd like a bit of knowledge to cheer you up," Perlmutter laughed. "What precisely do you wish to know?"
"When Drake seized the Concepcion, how did he handle the cargo?"
"The event was quite well recorded. He loaded the gold and silver bullion, including a hoard of precious gems and pearls, on board the Golden Hind. The amount was enormous. His ship was dangerously overloaded, so he dumped several tons of the silver into the water by Cano Island off the coast of Ecuador before continuing on his voyage around the world."
"But what about the Inca treasures?"
"They were left in the cargo holds of the Concepcion. Drake then put a prize crew on board to sail her back through the Magellan Strait and across the Atlantic to England.
Did the galleon reach port?
No, answered Perlmutter thoughtfully. It went missing and was presumed lost with all hands.
I'm sorry to hear that, said Pitt, disappointment in his voice. I had hopes it might have somehow survived.
Come to think of it, recalled Perlmutter, a myth did arise concerning the Concepcion's disappearance.
What was the gist of it?
A fanciful story, little more than rumor, said the galleon was caught in a tidal wave that carried it far inland. Never verified or documented, of course.
Do you have a source for the rumor?
A further research will be needed to verify details, but if my memory serves me correctly, the tale came from a mad Englishman the Portuguese reported finding in a village along the Amazon River. Sorry, that's about all I can give you on the spur of the moment.
I'd be grateful if you dug a little deeper, said Pitt.
I can give you the dimensions and tonnage of the Concepcion, how much sail she carried, when and where she was built. But a crazy person wandering around a rainforest calls for a source outside my collection.
If anyone can track down a sea mystery, you can.
I have an utter lack of willpower when it comes to delving into one of your enigmas, especially after we found old Abe Lincoln on a Confederate ironclad in the middle of the Sahara Desert together.
I leave it to you, Julian.
Ironclads in a desert, Noah's Ark on a mountain, Spanish galleons in a jungle. Why don't ships stay on the sea where they belong?
That's why you and I are incurable lost shipwreck hunters, said Pitt cheerfully.
What's your interest in this one? Perlmutter asked warily.
A jade box containing a knotted cord that gives directions to an immense Inca treasure. Perlmutter mulled over Pitt's brief answer for several seconds before he finally said,
Well, I guess that's as good a reason as any.
Hiram Yeager looked as if he should have been pushing a shopping cart full of shabby belongings down a back alley. He was attired in a Levi's jacket and pants, his long blonde hair tied in a loose ponytail, and his boyish face half hidden by a scraggly beard. The only shopping cart Yeager ever pushed, however, was down the delicatessen aisle of a supermarket. A stranger would have been hard-pressed to imagine him living in a fashionable residential area of Maryland with a lovely artist wife and two pretty, smart teenage girls in private school and driving a top-of-the-line BMW. Nor would someone who didn't know him guess that he was chief of NUMA's communications and information network. Admiral Sandecker had pirated him away from a Silicon Valley computer corporation to build a vast data library, containing every book, article or thesis, scientific or historical, fact or theory, ever known to be written about the sea. What St. Julian Perlmutter's archive was to ships, Yeager's was to oceanography and the growing field of undersea sciences. He was sitting at his own private terminal in a small side office of the computer data complex that took up the entire 10th floor of the NUMA building when his phone buzzed. Without taking his eyes from a monitor that showed how ocean currents affected the climate around Australia, he picked up the receiver.
"Greetings from the Brain Trust," he answered casually.
"You wouldn't know gray matter if it splashed on your shoe," came the voice of an old friend.
"Good to hear from you, Mr. Special Projects Director. The office topic of the day says you're enjoying a fun-filled holiday in sunny South America."
"You heard wrong, pal."
"Are you calling from the deep fathom?"
"Yes, Al and I are back on board after a little excursion into the jungle."
"What can I do for you?"
"Delve into your data bank and see if you can find any record of a tidal wave that struck the shoreline between Lima, Peru, and Panama City sometime in March of 1578.
Yeager sighed.
Why don't you also ask me to find the temperature and humidity on the day of creation?
Adjust the general area where the wave struck will do, thank you.
Any record of such an event would likely be in old weather and maritime records I gleaned from Spanish archives in Seville. Another remote possibility would be the local inhabitants, who might have handed down legends of such an event. The Incas were good at recording social and religious occasions on textiles or pottery.
Not a good lead, Pitt said doubtfully.
The Inca Empire was smashed by the Spanish conquest nearly 40 years earlier. Whatever records they made in recalling the news of the day were scattered and lost.
Most tidal waves that come inland are caused by seafloor movement. Maybe I can piece together known geological events of that era.
Give it your best try.
How soon do you need it?
Unless the Admiral has you on a priority project, drop everything else and go.
All right, said Yeager, eager for the challenge. I'll see what I can come up with.
Thanks, Hiram. I owe you.
About 100 times over.
And don't mention this to Sandecker, said Pitt.
I thought it sounded like another one of your shady schemes. Mind telling me what this is all about?
I'm looking for a lost Spanish galleon in a jungle.
But of course, what else?
Yeager said with routine resignation. He had learned long before never to anticipate Pitt.
I'm hoping you can find me a ballpark to search. As a matter of fact, through clean living and moral thinking, I can already narrow your field of search by a wide margin.
What do you know that I don't?
Yeager smiled to himself.
The lowlands between the west flank of the Andes and the coast of Peru have an average temperature of 18 degrees Celsius, or 65 degrees Fahrenheit, and an annual rainfall that would hardly fill a shot glass, making it one of the world's coldest and driest low-altitude deserts. No jungle for a ship to get lost in there.
So, what's your hot spot? Asked Pitt.
Ecuador. The coastal region is tropical all the way to Panama.
A precision display of deductive reasoning.
You're okay, Hiram. I don't care what your ex-wives say about you.
A mere trifle. I'll have something for you in 24 hours.
I'll be in touch.
As soon as he put down the phone, Yeager began assembling his thoughts. He never failed to find the novelty of a shipwreck search stimulating. The areas he planned to investigate were neatly filed in the computer of his mind. During his years with Numa, he had discovered that Dirk Pitt didn't walk through life like other men. Simply working with Pitt and supplying data information had been one long, intrigue-filled, vicarious adventure. And Yeager took pride in the fact that he had never fumbled the ball that was passed to him.